Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
New England, like most of the U.S., is seeing another wave of COVID cases. The Omicron subvariant called XBB is responsible for nearly half of all new infections. Basically 49%, according to CDC data from January 21st. And here in the Commonwealth, a post-holiday surge in cases is slowly declining, but the virus still very much present. So we had questions, and it turns out you have a lot of questions, too. So let's ask the doctors. Dr. Shira Daron is an epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, an associate professor at Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Benjamin Linus is a professor of medicine at Boston University's School of Medicine and an infectious disease specialist at the Boston Medical Center. Both doctors we have been talking to really since the beginning of the pandemic. Dr. Daron, welcome back.
Great to be back.
And Dr. Linus, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So listen, we asked our Radio Boston texting group community if they had questions for today, and we got so many questions that we're going to dive right in and ask a few of theirs before we even get to ours. So Dr. Daron, Shyla in Boston says, what are their, meaning the two of you, thoughts on the efficacy of the latest bivalent vaccine with regard to the current variants of COVID? So maybe start by reminding us when the bivalent came out, where we were in the variants, and how effective you think it is given where we are right now.
Okay. So the current bivalent booster vaccine contains the code for the BA4 and 5 Omicron subvariant, plus the original Wuhan strain that is in the original vaccine as well. And the creation of that vaccine, the manufacture and distribution, was a gamble that was made by looking at the circulating variants at the time and hoping that BA.4/5 would still be predominant by the time the vaccine was released, which was in September. And the gamble paid off in a sense because BA.4/BA.5 was still quite dominant at the time as the first doses were going in. But as it has always been the case over the past year since Omicron emerged, every couple of months we do see new subvariants emerge and become predominant. And so we are now in a place where other subvariants that are not so similar to BA.4/5 are now predominant. And so the question is, how well does the bivalent vaccine work against the currently circulating strains? Right now, we are seeing a predominance of XBB.1.5. And we don't have clinical data to answer that question. We didn't have clinical data on how effective the bivalent booster would be against even the strains it was targeting. We know that that laboratory data suggests that the vaccines don't neutralize the current variants as well as they would BA.4/5, for example.
So,
but we believe that all boosters are effective and enhance your protection against severe disease.
Okay, so a couple of things there. First, I'm just so acutely aware, especially this week after the mass shooting in Monterey Park, of sort of concerns about how we're framing things. And when you say the Wuhan virus, that was in fact how the original virus was termed in terms of tracing source so that we could do epidemiology, correct? Okay. And second, when you say we didn't really have data, if I understand it, Dr. Daron, it's because the bivalent boosters actually were authorized for emergency use without the same kind of testing that previous versions of COVID vaccines had gone through. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. So now we've got some lab data, but we don't have the kind of tests on people and long-term outcomes to really know how effective they are. Is that correct?
Yes, the CDC has released a couple of MMWRs. It's reports that it issues on effectiveness using retrospective data, so not clinical trials, but looking back who did and did not take the vaccine. And they show some effectiveness data there. Those are subject to some biases, but they aren't based on the currently circulating variants.
Great. All right. So really robust answer there to Shyla in Boston. Dr. Linus, it sounds like you want to add, and I'm going to let you, but why don't we do two things at once? Let me give you John and West Roxbury's question, and then you can build on to what Dr. Durone said and pick up John as well. If the use-by date on a COVID test has been reached and hasn't been extended, which one can discover online at COVID.gov, is the test useless? Is the result of a truly expired test unreliable? So over to you now, Dr. Linus.
Great. So before we move to testing, I want to put in one more word on vaccine, which is just to make it very clear that every study has shown that whatever version of vaccine you have once boosted, be it the original vaccine or the bivalent, is still highly effective at preventing you from dying of COVID. So I just want to make sure that that's very clear, that with all of the sort of machinations and discussions of how to use these vaccines, every study has shown that people who take vaccine are 90%, you know, up to 90% less likely to die from COVID. And I think that's the bottom line that I want to make sure people hear.
Thanks.
Regarding testing, so I'm a decision scientist. I think a lot about test characteristics and how sensitive tests are and how specific tests are and what it means to have a positive or negative test. If the test is expired, you know, in reality, if someone looked carefully, often you could extend the life of that test beyond the expiration date. And we've seen that happen. That said, in the real world, if you're looking at a test in your cabinet and it is expired and you can't see that it has been extended, that means that no one's really done the work to see if it's still valid. And you can't really trust a result, certainly a negative result. And so I would recommend going out to find a new test.
And Dr. Linus, as I understand it, a wide number of insurance companies, if one has medical insurance, will provide a certain number of COVID tests free every month. So you might not have to pay to go replace that test.
Oh, absolutely. So definitely check with your insurer. I know, you know, I have my insurer covers tests, and I can go to a local pharmacy and pick them up for free. It's quite simple, and you'll come home with a stack of boxes that you can keep for a little while.
Thanks. That's helpful. So, Dr. Shira Durone, back to you. And I can honestly say, in all my years of doing Ask the Doctors, I've never had this question from a listener before. So here we go. Leo in Cambridge says, does my beard decrease the effectiveness of a high-grade mask to such an extent that I would be better off under a couple of layers of surgical masks?
Yes, a beard will affect the seal of an N95. We know that from hospital fit testing. In fact, according to infection control rules, OSHA rules, et cetera, healthcare workers with beards are not supposed to wear N95s at all. They're supposed to wear a device called a PAPR, which does not rely on a seal. It's a powered device. So that is true. Now, that does not mean that layering two surgical masks on top of each other fixes the problem. The surgical masks filter well. The issue is the fit, that it doesn't have the tight fit that an N95 is, and that's why they don't work as well as an N95. So layering two on top of each other will not get you additional protection.
But that doesn't mean Leo and Cambridge shouldn't mask at all? I mean, is there some level of efficacy from the mask despite the beard?
Yes, that's a good point. Your mask fit does not have to be perfect to get some efficacy. Right. I wouldn't go into a COVID patient's room in the hospital with a beard and an N95 thinking that I had the same protection, but that does not mean that it renders the device, the respirator useless.
So we'll go back to listener questions in a moment, and you can join our texting group to ask questions on these and other segments by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. And if you missed that, you can find that phone number on our website, radioboston.org/about. So now I want to come back, and I just want to talk to the two of you for a second, Dr. Durone, Dr. Linus. We have walked together through this pandemic, and I just kind of want to know where each of you, based on the experiences you're seeing at Tufts Medical Center for Dr. Durone, Boston Medical Center for Dr. Linus, where are we? Do you feel like we're moving from pandemic to endemic? Do you feel like we're hitting a steady state? Or does it still feel like something different and scary and present for you? Dr. Linus, you first.
I think that's an important question. I mean, I think that certainly we're progressing through this experience. And I'm hesitant to put labels like endemic onto where we are now because they have real sort of epidemiologic precise meaning that I think, you know, in our more public discourse, we're taking endemic to sort of mean moving on, right? That this is done. And I don't think we're there. I mean, I still think we're seeing a lot of excess mortality because of this virus. And it's not immediately apparent to everybody. But if you look at how many people are dying every day in the United States, it still far exceeds what we would have expected historically. And the explanation for that really is COVID, even if we don't fully understand all of it, and even if it doesn't look the same as it looked in 2020. That said, I think it also would be not fair and not right and discouraging to try to pretend that it still is 2020. Clearly, we've made remarkable progress. I think we have to acknowledge that the invention of the vaccine was really one of the most remarkable things in the history of science and human ingenuity, that because of all that work with vaccine, because of all the work people have been doing to become vaccinated, and also because we've experienced this for 3 years and we do have broad, most people have had COVID at least once, right? The level of immunity in our community is different. And so this is a different disease. But it's a difficult time, I think, because there's a desire for this again. Right? Throughout the pandemic, we've occasionally talked about the idea that people want things to either be on or off, zero or one. It's a pandemic or it's over. And it's not. We're in this difficult phase where there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't really understand all the implications of many COVID infections over the long term. And we really just don't understand exactly how to be vaccinating now either, right? What's the optimal vaccine schedule? And so there's still work to be done. I think we're making progress. I think it is important for people to be engaging in their lives and not to let COVID be the overarching decision maker for everything that they do. But at the same time, I think it still needs to be in our decision making, and people need to be taking steps to reduce their risk and reduce the risk of others when possible. And I know that's not a straightforward answer, but I think it's the honest answer today.
So, Dr. Derone, anything you'd want to add there?
You know, when I look at the hospital, COVID today looks so different than COVID in 2020. COVID patients really are so much like patients with the other respiratory viruses, whereas in 2020, they were so different. They had severe lung involvement. They could be people without any risk factors whatsoever who became very sick quickly and died. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing so few critically ill COVID patients today. So it is sort of fading into the background of a respiratory virus season from a sort of healthcare standpoint. However, when I look at the hospital and the impact that the pandemic in general has had, first of all, just the trauma that we all went through from 2020 and 21 and taking care of so many sick patients and being so full at times that we were taking care of patients in spaces that we shouldn't have been taking care of patients in. I mean, and now the mass exodus from the workforce and the staffing shortages that we're facing, it is still a very, very difficult time from a healthcare standpoint. On a personal level, though, I am living my life very, very much like I did in 2018.
All right. That's very helpful. So with those two answers in mind, I'm going to pick up some listener questions here from our texting group. You text Boston to 617-766-0382. And I'd like to do a lightning round, doctors, where we do quick questions, quick answers, and plow through a few of these. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Linus, Luke in Boston, how do you feel about the general population not really wearing masks anymore? Is this a mistake or will it be all right?
I think that, like all things, for no one to ever wear a mask again might be a mistake. But at the same time, for all of us to be masking everywhere we go is clearly not necessary at this point. We've seen that. We haven't seen a huge surge in cases this winter after a mild bump from the holidays. So I think it's important to gauge your risk. People know the risk factors now for severe COVID. If you're working with and hanging around people, or if you have those risks, then you should be wearing masks in closed settings. And at other times, you don't need to. So if you're going to go to your family's wedding and you want to experience that without a mask, that's absolutely appropriate in 2023. So again, not straightforward, and maybe I'm talking too much for a lightning round, but that's what I would say.
Seems like that was pretty important to get that whole thing in. So now I'll turn to you, Dr. Derone. Nancy in Cambridge, I see lots and lots of people at restaurants. I cringe and think that's not safe. I mean, no one's masked. My husband and I, were around 70 but pretty healthy, have had all the COVID vaccinations and boosters, the latest on September 7th. Are restaurants safe? I miss eating out.
You know, we cannot just use the word safe these days. There are things that are safer, and there are things that are less safe from a COVID standpoint. I would think about it this way. This is as good as it gets. Maybe we'll have periods of time where cases are lower than now, but maybe not. This may be it forever. And think about what you're willing to give up forever. And we have always taken risks in life when we do things during flu season, when we drive a car, when we swim in an ocean. So it is everybody's personal choice at this point.
All right, Dr. Linus Elgeyan-Mattapan, how soon after recovering from COVID can I get a booster shot?
Most people recommend waiting 2 to 3 months.
Okay. And Dr. Daron Elizabeth and Roslindare, what are your recommended quarantine protocols to protect others at home and work? Where are we with that protocol right now, Dr. Daron?
Mm-hmm. So quarantine means when you stay home after you've been exposed and there are no longer any quarantine protocols. Isolation is when you stay home when you have COVID. And the recommendation is 5 days at home. And then if you feel well enough, your symptoms are improving, 5 more days with a mask around everyone. So no restaurants. And then you can stop provided you are not immunocompromised.
And if you've been exposed, Dr. Linus, is that a moment where you would recommend somebody wearing a mask for a few days to help protect others?
Yeah, I would recommend that. If you know that you've been exposed and you're in close contact, I think that most people would like to think that if someone knew that they were exposed and might be spreading disease, that they would take steps to prevent doing that. And so in sort of the spirit of do unto others, I would wear a mask if you know you've been exposed.
All right. So Elizabeth and Roslindale wants to know part of Elizabeth's question. Are there any updates on vaccines that actually prevent infection and transmission? We have gotten to a point where our vaccines, as the two of you have emphasized, are very good at preventing severe illness and death. We are aware that the new variants are better at evading the prevention from transmission at all. Is there anything on the horizon, Dr. Daron, that might get at the transmission thing?
No, there are a lot of ongoing trials for new vaccine technology. And you'll see a lot in the newspapers saying, well, maybe nasal vaccines will be the answer. I'm not sure nasal vaccines will be the answer. They were not the answer for influenza. And we know that even natural, quote unquote, infection with coronaviruses does not provide that kind of sterilizing immunity that prevents infection in the future. So we should keep trying, but I'm not sure we should count on that happening.
And Dr. Linus Elaine in Cambridge wants to know, how long can you wear an N95 mask before it needs to be replaced?
It depends a bit on the make and what N95 you're wearing, but you can start to tell when they need to be replaced because they start to get those little fibers on the inside that tickle your nose and they start to visibly break down, and that's when it's time to replace it.
So if it's nice and smooth on the inside, you're probably still in good shape.
You're probably still in good shape.
All right. And if somebody's had the bivalent booster, this is a summary of several other questions. Can they go get another one after a few months? Dr. Daron.
No, that would violate the emergency use authorization.
Okay. I think we'll stop there. I feel like it's been a while since we've done this, and it's clear there's so much more to do. But I'm always grateful for your precious time. Dr. Shira Daron, epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Benjamin Linus, infectious disease specialist at the Boston Medical Center, appreciate you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.